and the one you grow up in. Your dad and I will sell the first a couple years after your arrival. I'll sell the second shortly after your departure. By then, Nelson and I will have moved into our farmhouse, and your dad will be living with... what's her name? I know how this story ends. I think about it a lot. I also think a lot about how it began. Just a few years ago, when ships appeared in orbit and artifacts appeared in meadows. The government said next to nothing about them, while the tabloids said every possible thing. And then I got a phone call, a request for a meeting. I spotted them waiting in the hallway, outside my office. They made an odd couple. One wore a military uniform and a crew cut, and carried an aluminum briefcase. He seemed to be assessing his surroundings with a critical eye. The other one was easily identifiable as an academic, full beard and mustache, wearing corduroy. He was browsing through the overlapping sheets stapled to a bulletin board nearby. "Colonel Weber, I presume?" I shook hands with the soldier. "Louise Banks."
"Dr. Banks, thank you for taking the time to speak with us," he said.
"Not at all. Any excuse to avoid the faculty meeting?" Colonel Weber indicated his companion.
"This is Dr. Gary Donnelly, the physicist I mentioned when we spoke on the phone."
"Call me Gary," he said as we shook hands. "I'm anxious to hear what you have to say." We entered my office. I moved a couple of stacks of books off the second guest chair, and we all sat down. "You said you wanted me to listen to a recording. I presume this has something to do with the aliens?"
"All I can offer is a recording," said Colonel Weber.
"Okay, let's hear it." Colonel Weber took a tape machine out of his briefcase and pressed play. The recording sounded vaguely like that of a wet dog shaking the water out of its fur.
"What do you make of that?" he asked.
I withheld my comparison to a wet dog. "What was the context in which this recording was made?"
"I'm not at liberty to say."
"It would help me interpret those sounds. Could you see the alien while it was speaking? Was it doing anything at the time?"
"The recording is all I can offer."
"You won't be giving anything away if you tell me that you've seen the aliens. The public's assumed you have." Colonel Weber wasn't budging.
"Do you have any opinion about its linguistic properties?" he asked.
"Well, it's clear that their vocal tract is substantially different from a human vocal tract. I assume that these aliens don't look like humans." The colonel was about to say something noncommittal when Gary Donnelly asked,
"Can you make any guesses based on the tape?"
"Not really. It doesn't sound like they're using a larynx to make those sounds, but that doesn't tell me what they look like."
"Anything. Is there anything else you can tell us?"
asked Colonel Weber. I could see he wasn't accustomed to consulting a civilian. Only that establishing communications is going to be really difficult because of the difference in anatomy. They're almost certainly using sounds that the human vocal tract can't reproduce, and maybe sounds that the human ear can't distinguish.
"You mean infra- or ultrasonic frequencies?"
asked Gary Donnelly. "Not specifically. I just mean that the human auditory system isn't an absolute acoustic instrument. It's optimized to recognize the sounds that a human larynx makes. With an alien vocal system, all bets are off." I shrugged. "Maybe we'll be able to hear the difference between alien phonemes, given enough practice. But it's possible our ears simply can't recognize the distinctions they consider meaningful. In that case, we'd need a sound spectrograph to know what an alien is saying." Colonel Weber asked,
"Suppose I gave you an hour's worth of recordings. How long would it take you to determine if we need this sound spectrograph or not?"
"I couldn't determine that with just a recording, no matter how much time I had. I'd need to talk with the aliens directly." The colonel shook his head.
"Not possible."
I tried to break it to him gently. "That's your call, of course. But the only way to learn an unknown language is to interact with a native speaker, and by that I mean asking questions, holding a conversation, that sort of thing. Without that, it's simply not possible. So if you want to learn the alien's language, someone with training in field linguistics,
whether it's me or someone else, we'll have to talk with an alien. Recordings alone aren't sufficient.
Colonel Weber frowned.
You seem to be implying that no alien could have learned human languages by monitoring our broadcasts.
I doubt it.
They'd need instructional material specifically designed to teach human languages to non-humans. Either that or interaction with a human. If they had either of those, they could learn a lot from TV. But otherwise, they wouldn't have a starting point.
The Colonel clearly found this interesting.
Evidently, his philosophy was, the less the aliens knew, the better. Gary Donnelly read the Colonel's expression, too, and rolled his eyes.
I suppressed a smile.
Then Colonel Weber asked, Suppose you were learning a new language by talking to its speakers. Could you do it without teaching them English?
That would depend on how cooperative the native speakers were. They'd almost certainly pick up bits and pieces while I'm learning their language. But it wouldn't have to be much if they're willing to teach.
On the other hand, if they'd rather learn English than teach us their language, that would make things far more difficult.
The Colonel nodded.
I'll get back to you on this matter.
The request for that meeting was perhaps the second most momentous phone call in my life. The first, of course, will be the one from Mountain Rescue. At that point, your dad and I will be speaking to each other maybe once a year, tops. After I get that phone call, though, the first thing I'll do will be to call your father. He and I will drive out together to perform the identification. A long, silent car ride. I remember the morgue, all tile and stainless steel, the hum of refrigeration and smell of antiseptic. An orderly will pull the sheet back to reveal your face. Your face will look wrong somehow, but I'll know it's you. Yes, that's her, I'll say. She's mine.
You'll be 25 then. The MP checked my badge, made a notation on his clipboard, and opened the gate. I drove the off-road vehicle into the encampment, a small village of tents pitched by the army in a farmer's sun-scorched pasture. At the center of the encampment was one of the alien devices, nicknamed Looking Glasses. According to the briefings I'd attended, there were 9 of these in the United States, 112 in the world. The looking glasses acted as 2-way communication devices, presumably with the ships in orbit. No one knew why the aliens wouldn't talk to us in person. Fear of cooties, maybe. A team of scientists, including a physicist and a linguist, was assigned to each looking glass. Gary Donnelly and I were on this one. Gary was waiting for me in the parking area. We navigated a circular maze of concrete barricades until we reached the large tent that covered the looking glass itself. In front of the tent was an equipment cart loaded with goodies borrowed from the school's phonology lab. I had sent it ahead for inspection by the army. Also, outside the tent were 3 tripod-mounted video cameras whose lenses peered through windows in the fabric wall into the main room. Everything Gary and I did would be reviewed by countless others, including military intelligence. In addition, we would each send daily reports, of which mine had to include estimates on how much English I thought the aliens could understand. Gary held open the tent flap and gestured for me to enter.
"Step right up," he said, Circus Barker style. "Marvel at creatures the likes of which have never been seen on God's green earth."
"And all for one slim dime," I murmured, walking through the door. At the moment, the looking glass was inactive, resembling a semicircular mirror over 10 feet high and 20 feet across. On the brown grass in front of the looking glass, an arc of white spray paint outlined the activation area. Currently, the area contained only a table, 2 folding chairs, and a power strip with a cord leading to a generator outside. The buzz of fluorescent lamps hung from poles along the edge of the room, commingled with the buzz of flies and the sweltering heat. Gary and I looked at each other, and then began pushing the cart of equipment up to the table. As we crossed the paint line, the looking glass appeared to grow transparent. It was as if someone was slowly raising the illumination behind tinted glass. The illusion of depth was uncanny. I felt I could walk right into it. Once the looking glass was fully lit, it resembled a life-size diorama of a semicircular room. The room contained a few large objects that might have been furniture, but no aliens. There was a door in the curved rear wall. We busied ourselves connecting everything together: microphone, sound spectrograph, portable computer, and speaker. As we worked, I frequently glanced at the looking glass, anticipating the alien's arrival. Even so, I jumped when one of them entered. It looked like a barrel suspended at the intersection of seven limbs. It was radially symmetric, and any of its limbs could serve as an arm or a leg. The one in front of me was walking around on four legs, three non-adjacent arms curled up at its sides. Gary called them heptapods. I'd been shown videotapes, but I still gawked. Its limbs had no distinct joints. Anatomists guessed they might be supported by vertebral columns. Whatever their underlying structure, the heptapod's limbs conspired to move it in a disconcertingly fluid manner. Its torso rode atop the rippling limbs as smoothly as a hovercraft. Seven lidless eyes ringed the top of the heptapod's body. It walked back to the doorway from which it entered, made a brief sputtering sound, and returned to the center of the room followed by another heptapod. At no point did it ever turn around. Eerie, but logical, with eyes on all sides, any direction might as well be forward. Gary had been watching my reaction. "Ready?" he asked. I took a deep breath. "Ready enough." I'd done plenty of fieldwork before, in the Amazon, but it had always been a bilingual procedure. Either my informants knew some Portuguese, which I could use, or I'd previously gotten an intro to their language from the local missionaries. This would be my first attempt at conducting a true monolingual discovery procedure. It was straightforward enough in theory, though. I walked up to the looking glass and a heptapod on the other side did the same. The image was so real that my skin crawled. I could see the texture of its gray skin, like corduroy ridges arranged in whorls and loops. There was no smell at all from the looking glass, which somehow made the situation stranger. I pointed to myself and said slowly, "Human." Then I pointed to Gary. "Human." Then I pointed at each heptapod and said, "What are you?" No reaction. I tried again, and then again. One of the heptapods pointed to itself with one limb, the four terminal digits pressed together. That was lucky. In some cultures, a person pointed with his chin. If the heptapod hadn't used one of its limbs, I wouldn't have known what gesture to look for. I heard a brief fluttering sound and saw a puckered orifice at the top of its body vibrate. It was talking. Then it pointed to its companion and fluttered again. I went back to my computer. On its screen were two virtually identical spectrographs representing the fluttering sounds. I marked a sample for playback. I pointed to myself and said, "Human," again, and did the same with Gary. Then I pointed to the heptapod and played back the flutter on the speaker. The heptapod fluttered some more. The second half of the spectrograph for this utterance looked like a repetition. Call the previous utterances flutter one. Then this one was flutter two, flutter one. I pointed at something that might have been a heptapod chair. "What is that?" The heptapod paused and then pointed at the chair and talked some more. The spectrograph for this differed distinctly from that of the earlier sounds, flutter three. Once again, I pointed to the chair while playing back flutter three. The heptapod replied,
Judging by the spectrograph, it looked like Flutter 3, Flutter 2. Optimistic interpretation, the heptapod was confirming my utterances as correct, which implied compatibility between heptapod and human patterns of discourse. Pessimistic interpretation, it had a nagging cough. At my computer, I delimited certain sections of the spectrograph and typed in a tentative gloss for each. Heptapod for Flutter 1, yes for Flutter 2, and chair for Flutter 3. Then I typed Language Heptapod A as a heading for all the utterances. Gary watched what I was typing.
What's the A for?
It just distinguishes this language from any other ones heptapods might use, I said. He nodded. Now let's try something just for laughs. I pointed at each heptapod and tried to mimic the sound of Flutter 1 heptapod. After a long pause, the first heptapod said something, and then the second one said something else, neither of whose spectrographs resembled anything said before. I couldn't tell if they were speaking to each other or to me, since they had no faces to turn. I tried pronouncing Flutter 1 again, but there was no reaction. Not even close, I grumbled.
I'm impressed you can make sounds like that at all, said Gary.
You should hear my moose call. Sends them running. I tried again a few more times, but neither heptapod responded with anything I could recognize. Only when I replayed the recording of the heptapod's pronunciation did I get a confirmation. The heptapod replied with Flutter 2, yes.
So we're stuck with using recordings? Asked Gary.
I nodded. At least temporarily.
So now what?
Now we make sure it hasn't actually been saying, aren't they cute, or look what they're doing now. Then we see if we can identify any of these words when that other heptapod pronounces them. I gestured for him to have a seat. Get comfortable. This'll take a while. In 1770, Captain Cook's ship Endeavour ran aground on the coast of Queensland, Australia. While some of his men made repairs, Cook led an exploration party and met the Aboriginal people. One of the sailors pointed to the animals that hopped around with their young riding in pouches and asked an Aborigine what they were called. The Aborigine replied, "Kangaroo." From then on, Cook and his sailors referred to the animals by this word. It wasn't until later that they learned it meant, "What did you say?" I tell that story in my introductory course every year. It's almost certainly untrue, and I explain that afterwards, but it's a classic anecdote. Of course, the anecdotes my undergraduates will really want to hear are ones featuring the heptapods for the rest of my teaching career. That'll be the reason many of them sign up for my courses. So I'll show them the old videotapes of my sessions at the Looking Glass and the sessions that the other linguists conducted. The tapes are instructive, and they'll be useful if we're ever visited by aliens again, but they don't generate many good anecdotes. When it comes to language learning anecdotes, my favorite source is child language acquisition. I remember one afternoon when you were 5 years old, after you have come home from kindergarten. You'll be coloring with your crayons while I grade papers. "Mom," you'll say, using the carefully casual tone reserved for requesting a favor, "can I ask you something?"
"Sure, sweetie. Go ahead."
"Can I be, honored?"
I'll look up from the paper I'm grading. "What do you mean?"
"At school, Sharon said she got to be honored."
"Really? Did she tell you what for?"
"It was when her big sister got married. She said only one person could be, honored, and she was it."
"Ah, I see. You mean Sharon was maid of honor."
"Yeah, that's it. Can I be maid of honor?"
Gary and I entered the prefab building containing the center of operations for the Looking Glass site. Inside, it looked like they were planning an invasion, or perhaps an evacuation. Crew-cut soldiers worked around a large map of the area, or sat in front of burly electronic gear while speaking into headsets. We were shown into Colonel Weber's office, a room in the back that was cool from air conditioning. We briefed the colonel on our first day's results.
"Doesn't sound like you got very far," he said.
"I have an idea as to how we can make faster progress.
I said. But you'll have to approve the use of more equipment.
What more do you need?
A digital camera and a big video screen. I showed him a drawing of the setup I imagined. I want to try conducting the discovery procedure using writing. I display words on the screen and use the camera to record the words they write. I'm hoping the heptapods will do the same. Weber looked at the drawing dubiously.
What would be the advantage of that?
So far, I've been proceeding the way I would with speakers of an unwritten language. Then it occurred to me that the heptapods must have writing, too.
So?
If the heptapods have a mechanical way of producing writing, then their writing ought to be very regular, very consistent. That would make it easier for us to identify graphemes instead of phonemes. It's like picking out the letters in a printed sentence instead of trying to hear them when the sentence is spoken aloud.
I take your point,
he admitted.
And how would you respond to them? Show them the words they display to you?
Basically. And if they put spaces between words, any sentences we write would be a lot more intelligible than any spoken sentence we might splice together from recordings. He leaned back in his chair.
You know we want to show as little of our technology as possible.
I understand, but we're using machines as intermediaries already. If we can get them to use writing, I believe progress will go much faster than if we're restricted to the sound spectrographs.
The colonel turned to Gary. Your opinion? Sounds like a good idea to me. I'm curious whether the heptapods might have difficulty reading our monitors. Their looking glasses are based on a completely different technology than our video screens. As far as we can tell, they don't use pixels or scan lines, and they don't refresh on a frame-by-frame basis. You think the scan lines on our video screens might render them unreadable to the heptapods? It's possible, said Gary. We'll just have to try it and see.
Weber considered it. For me, it wasn't even a question. But from his point of view, it was a difficult decision. Like a soldier, though, he made it quickly.
Request granted. Talk to the sergeant outside about bringing in what you need. Have it ready for tomorrow.
I remember one day during the summer when you're 16. For once, the person waiting for her date to arrive is me. Of course, you'll be waiting around, too, curious to see what he looks like. You'll have a friend of yours, a blonde girl with the unlikely name of Roxy, hanging out with you, giggling. You may feel the urge to make comments about him, I'll say, checking myself in the hallway mirror. Just restrain yourselves until we leave. Don't worry, Mom, you'll say. We'll do it so that he won't know. Roxy, you ask me what I think the weather will be like tonight. Then I'll say what I think of Mom's date. Right, Roxy will say. No, you most definitely will not, I'll say. Relax, Mom. He'll never know. We do this all the time. What a comfort that is. A little later on, Nelson will arrive to pick me up. I'll do the introductions, and we'll all engage in a little small talk on the front porch. Nelson is ruggedly handsome to your evident approval. Just as we're about to leave, Roxy will say to you casually, "So what do you think the weather will be like tonight?"
"I think it's going to be really hot,"
he'll answer. Roxy will nod in agreement. Nelson will say,
"Really? I thought they said it was going to be cool."
"I have a sixth sense about these things,"
he'll say. Your face will give nothing away.
"I get the feeling it's going to be a scorcher. Good thing you're dressed for it, Mom."
I'll glare at you and say good night. As I lead Nelson toward his car, he'll ask me, amused,
"I'm missing something here, aren't I?"
"A private joke," I'll mutter. "Don't ask me to explain it." At our next session at the Looking Glass, we repeated the procedure we had performed before, this time displaying a printed word on our computer screen at the same time we spoke, showing human while saying human, and so forth. Eventually, the heptapods understood what we wanted and set up a flat, circular screen mounted on a small pedestal. One heptapod spoke and then inserted a limb into a large socket in the pedestal. A doodle of script, vaguely cursive, popped onto the screen. We soon settled into a routine, and I compiled two parallel corpora, one of spoken utterances, one of writing samples. Based on first impressions, their writing appeared to be logographic, which was disappointing.
I'd been hoping for an alphabetic script to help us learn their speech. Their logograms might include some phonetic information, but finding it would be a lot harder than with an alphabetic script. By getting up close to the looking glass, I was able to point to various heptapod body parts, such as limbs, digits, and eyes, and elicit terms for each. It turned out that they had an orifice on the underside of their body, lined with articulated bony ridges, probably used for eating, while one at the top was for respiration and speech. There were no other conspicuous orifices. Perhaps their mouth was their anus, too. These sorts of questions would have to wait. I also tried asking our two informants for terms for addressing each individually, personal names, if they had such things. Their answers were, of course, unpronounceable, so for Gary's and my purposes, I dubbed them Flapper and Raspberry. I hoped I'd be able to tell them apart. The next day, I conferred with Gary before we entered the looking glass tent. "I'll need your help with this session," I told him.
"Sure. What do you want me to do?"
"We need to elicit some verbs, and it's easiest with third-person forms. Would you act out a few verbs while I type the written form on the computer? If we're lucky, the heptapods will figure out what we're doing and do the same. I brought a bunch of props for you to use."
"No problem," said Gary, cracking his knuckles. "Ready when you are."
We began with some simple intransitive verbs. Walking, jumping, speaking, writing. Gary demonstrated each one with a charming lack of self-consciousness. The presence of the video cameras didn't inhibit him at all. For the first few actions he performed, I asked the heptapods, "What do you call that?" Before long, the heptapods caught on to what we were trying to do. Raspberry began mimicking Gary, or at least performing the equivalent heptapod action, while Flapper worked their computer, displaying a written description and pronouncing it aloud. In the spectrographs of their spoken utterances, I could recognize their word I had glossed as heptapod. The rest of each utterance was presumably the verb phrase. It looked like they had analogs of nouns and verbs, thank goodness. In their writing, however, things weren't as clear-cut. For each action, they had displayed a single logogram instead of two separate ones. At first, I thought they had written something like walks, with the subject implied. But why would Flapper say, "the heptapod walks," while writing walks, instead of maintaining parallelism? Then I noticed that some of the logograms looked like a logogram for heptapod, with some extra strokes added to one side or another. Perhaps their verbs could be written as affixes to a noun. If so, why was Flapper writing the noun in some instances but not in others? I decided to try a transitive verb. Substituting object words might clarify things. Among the props I'd bought were an apple and a slice of bread. "Okay," I said to Gary. "Show them the food and then eat some. First the apple, then the bread." Gary pointed at the golden delicious, and then he took a bite out of it, while I displayed the "what do you call that" expression. Then we repeated it with a slice of whole wheat. Raspberry left the room and returned with some kind of giant nut or gourd and a gelatinous ellipsoid. Raspberry pointed at the gourd, while Flapper said a word and displayed a logogram. Then Raspberry brought the gourd down between its legs. A crunching sound resulted, and the gourd reemerged minus a bite. There were corn-like kernels beneath the shell. Flapper talked and displayed a large logogram on their screen. The sound spectrograph for gourd changed when it was used in the sentence, possibly a case marker. The logogram was odd. After some study, I could identify graphic elements that resembled the individual logograms for heptapod and gourd. They looked as if they had been melted together with several extra strokes in the mix that presumably meant eat. Was it a multi-word ligature? Next, we got spoken and written names for the gelatin egg and descriptions of the act of eating it. The sound spectrograph for heptapod eats gelatin egg was analyzable. Gelatin egg bore a case marker, as expected, though the sentence's word order differed from last time. The written form, another large logogram, was another matter. This time it took much longer for me to recognize anything in it. Not only were the individual logograms melted together again, it looked as if the one for heptapod was laid on its back, while on top of it the logogram for gelatin egg was standing on its head. Uh-oh. I took another look at the writing for the simple noun-verb examples, the ones that had seemed inconsistent before. Now I realized all of them actually did contain the logogram for heptapod. Some were rotated and distorted by being combined with the various verbs, so I hadn't recognized them at first. "You guys have got to be kidding," I muttered.
"What's wrong?" asked Gary.
"Their script isn't word-divided. A sentence is written by joining the logograms with the constituent words. They join the logograms by rotating and modifying them. Take a look." I showed him how the logograms were rotated.
"So they can read a word with equal ease no matter how it's rotated," Gary said.
He turned to look at the heptapods, impressed.
"I wonder if it's a consequence of their body's radial symmetry. Their bodies have no forward direction, so maybe their writing doesn't either. Highly neat."
I couldn't believe it. I was working with someone who modified the word neat with highly. "It certainly is interesting," I said. "But it also means there's no easy way for us to write our own sentences in their language. We can't simply cut their sentences into individual words and recombine them. We'll have to learn the rules of their script before we can write anything legible. It's the same continuity problem we'd have had splicing together speech fragments, except applied to writing." I looked at Flapper and Raspberry in the looking glass, who were waiting for us to continue, and sighed. "You aren't going to make this easy for us, are you?" To be fair, the heptapods were completely cooperative. In the days that followed, they readily taught us their language without requiring us to teach them any more English. Colonel Weber and his cohorts pondered the implications of that, while I and the linguists at the other looking glasses met via video conferencing to share what we had learned about the heptapod language. The video conferencing made for an incongruous working environment. Our video screens were primitive compared to the heptapod's looking glasses, so that my colleagues seemed more remote than the aliens. The familiar was far away, while the bizarre was close at hand. It would be a while before we'd be ready to ask the heptapods why they had come, or to discuss physics well enough to ask them about their technology. For the time being, we worked on the basics: phonemics, graphemics, vocabulary, syntax. The heptapods at every looking glass were using the same language, so we were able to pool our data and coordinate our efforts. Our biggest source of confusion was the heptapods' writing. It didn't appear to be writing at all. It looked more like a bunch of intricate graphic designs. The logograms weren't arranged in rows or a spiral or any linear fashion. Instead, Flapper or Raspberry would write a sentence by sticking together as many logograms as needed into a giant conglomeration. This form of writing was reminiscent of primitive sign systems, which required a reader to know a message's context in order to understand it. Such systems were considered too limited for a systematic recording of information. Yet it was unlikely that the heptapods developed their level of technology with only an oral tradition. That implied one of three possibilities. The first was that the heptapods had a true writing system, but they didn't want to use it in front of us. Colonel Weber would identify with that one. The second was that the heptapods hadn't originated the technology they were using. They were illiterates using someone else's technology. The third, and most interesting to me, was that the heptapods were using a nonlinear system of orthography that qualified as true writing. I remember a conversation we'll have when you're in your junior year of high school. It'll be Sunday morning, and I'll be scrambling some eggs while you set the table for brunch. You'll laugh as you tell me about the party you went to last night.
"Oh, man," you'll say. "They're not kidding when they say that body weight makes a difference. I didn't drink any more than the guys did, but I got so much drunker."
I'll try to maintain a neutral, pleasant expression. I'll really try. Then you'll say,
"Oh, come on, Mom."
"What?"
"You know you did the exact same things when you were my age."
I did nothing of the sort. But I know that if I were to admit that, you'd lose respect for me completely. You know never to drive or get into a car if...
God, of course I know that. Do you think I'm an idiot?
No, of course not. What I'll think is that you are clearly, maddeningly not me. It will remind me, again, that you won't be a clone of me. You can be wonderful, a daily delight, but you won't be someone I could have created by myself. The military had set up a trailer containing our offices at the Looking Glass site. I saw Gary walking toward the trailer and ran to catch up with him. It's a semasiographic writing system, I said when I reached him.
Excuse me, said Gary.
Here, let me show you.
I directed Gary into my office. Once we were inside, I went to the chalkboard and drew a circle with a diagonal line bisecting it.
What does this mean?
Not allowed.
Right. Next, I printed the words, not allowed, on the chalkboard, and so does this. But only one is a representation of speech.
Gary nodded.
Okay.
Linguists describe writing like this. I indicated the printed words as glottographic because it represents speech. Every human written language is in this category. However, this symbol, I indicated the circle and diagonal line, is semasiographic writing because it conveys meaning without reference to speech. There's no correspondence between its components and any particular sounds.
And you think all of heptapod writing is like this?
From what I've seen so far, yes. It's not picture writing. It's far more complex. It has its own system of rules for constructing sentences, like a visual syntax that's unrelated to the syntax for their spoken language.
A visual syntax. Can you show me an example?
Coming right up, I sat down at my desk and, using the computer, pulled up a frame from the recording of yesterday's conversation with Raspberry. I turned the monitor so he could see it. In their spoken language, a noun has a case marker indicating whether it's a subject or object. In their written language, however, a noun is identified as subject or object based on the orientation of its logogram relative to that of the verb. Here, take a look. I pointed at one of the figures. For instance, when heptapod is integrated with here's this way, with these strokes parallel, it means that the heptapod is doing the hearing. I showed him a different one. When they're combined this way, with the strokes perpendicular, it means that the heptapod is being heard. This morphology applies to several verbs. Another example is the inflection system. I called up another frame from the recording. In their written language, this logogram means roughly hear easily or hear clearly. See the elements it has in common with the logogram for hear? You can still combine it with heptapod in the same ways as before to indicate that the heptapod can hear something clearly or that the heptapod is clearly heard. But what's really interesting is that the modulation of hear into hear clearly isn't a special case. You see the transformation they applied?
Gary nodded, pointing. It's like they express the idea of clearly by changing the curve of those strokes in the middle.
Right. That modulation is applicable to lots of verbs. The logogram for see can be modulated in the same way to form see clearly, and so can the logogram for read and others. And changing the curve of those strokes has no parallel in their speech. With the spoken version of these verbs, they add a prefix to the verb to express ease of manner, and the prefixes for see and hear are different. There are other examples, but you get the idea. It's essentially a grammar in two dimensions. He began pacing thoughtfully.
Is there anything like this in human writing systems?
Mathematical equations, notations for music and dance. But those are all very specialized. We couldn't record this conversation using them, but I suspect if we knew it well enough, we could record this conversation in the heptapod writing system. I think it's a full-fledged, general-purpose graphical language.
Gary frowned. So their writing constitutes a completely separate language from their speech, right?
Right. In fact, it'd be more accurate to refer to the writing system as heptapod B and use heptapod A strictly for referring to the spoken language.
Hold on a second. Why use two languages when one would suffice? That seems unnecessarily hard to learn.
Like English spelling? I said. Ease of learning isn't the primary force in language evolution. For the heptapods, writing and speech may play such different cultural or cognitive roles that using separate languages makes more sense than using different forms of the same one. He considered it.
I see what you mean. Maybe they think our form of writing is redundant, like we're wasting a second communications channel.
That's entirely possible. Finding out why they use a second language for writing will tell us a lot about them.
So I take it this means we won't be able to use their writing to help us learn their spoken language.
I sighed.
Yeah, that's the most immediate implication.
But I don't think we should ignore either heptapod A or B. We need a two-pronged approach. I pointed at the screen. I'll bet you that learning their two-dimensional grammar will help you when it comes time to learn their mathematical notation.
You've got a point there. So, are we ready to start asking about their mathematics?
Not yet. We need a better grasp on this writing system before we begin anything else, I said, and then smiled when he mimed frustration.
Patience, good sir. Patience is a virtue.
You'll be 6 when your father has a conference to attend in Hawaii, and will accompany him. You'll be so excited that you'll make preparations for weeks beforehand. You'll ask me about coconuts and volcanoes and surfing and practice hula dancing in the mirror. You'll pack a suitcase with the clothes and toys you want to bring, and you'll drag it around the house to see how long you can carry it. You'll ask me if I can carry your Etch-a-Sketch in my bag, since there won't be any more room for it in yours, and you simply can't leave without it.
You won't need all of these, I'll say. There'll be so many fun things to do there, you won't have time to play with so many toys.
You'll consider that. Dimples will appear above your eyebrows when you think hard. Eventually, you'll agree to pack fewer toys, but your expectations will, if anything, increase.
I want to be in Hawaii now,
you'll whine. Sometimes it's good to wait, I'll say. The anticipation makes it more fun when you get there.
You'll just pout.
In the next report I submitted, I suggested that the term logogram was a misnomer because it implied that each graph represented a spoken word, when in fact the graphs didn't correspond to our notion of spoken words at all. I didn't want to use the term ideogram either, because of how it had been used in the past. I suggested the term semigram instead. It appeared that a semigram corresponded roughly to a written word in human languages. It was meaningful on its own, and in combination with other semigrams could form endless statements. We couldn't define it precisely,
but then no one had ever satisfactorily defined word for human languages either.
When it came to sentences in heptapod B, though, things became much more confusing. The language had no written punctuation. Its syntax was indicated in the way the semigrams were combined, and there was no need to indicate the cadence of speech. There was certainly no way to slice out subject-predicate pairings neatly to make sentences. A sentence seemed to be whatever number of semigrams a heptapod wanted to join together. The only difference between a sentence and a paragraph, or a page, was size. When a heptapod B sentence grew fairly sizable, its visual impact was remarkable. If I wasn't trying to decipher it, the writing looked like fanciful praying mantids drawn in a cursive style, all clinging to each other to form an escheresque lattice, each slightly different in its stance. And the biggest sentences had an effect similar to that of psychedelic posters, sometimes eye-watering, sometimes hypnotic. I remember a picture of you taken at your college graduation. In the photo, you're striking a pose for the camera, mortarboard stylishly tilted on your head, one hand touching your sunglasses, the other hand on your hip, holding open your gown to reveal the tank top and shorts you're wearing underneath. I remember your graduation. There will be the distraction of having Nelson and your father, and what's her name, there all at the same time, but that will be minor. That entire weekend, while you're introducing me to your classmates and hugging everyone incessantly,
I'll be all but mute with amazement. I can't believe that you, a grown woman taller than me and beautiful enough to make my heart ache, will be the same girl I used to lift off the ground so you could reach the drinking fountain. The same girl who used to trundle out of my bedroom draped in a dress and hat and 4 scarves from my closet. And after graduation, you'll be heading for a job as a financial analyst. I won't understand what you do there. I won't even understand your fascination with money, the preeminence you gave to salary when negotiating job offers. I would prefer it if you'd pursue something without regard for its monetary rewards, but I'll have no complaints. My own mother could never understand why I couldn't just be a high school English teacher. You'll do what makes you happy, and that'll be all I ask for. As time went on, the teams at each Looking Glass began working in earnest on learning heptapod terminology for elementary mathematics and physics. We worked together on presentations, with the linguists focusing on procedure and the physicists focusing on subject matter. The physicists showed us previously devised systems for communicating with aliens, based on mathematics, but those were intended for use over a radio telescope. We reworked them for face-to-face communication. Our teams were successful with basic arithmetic, but we hit a roadblock with geometry and algebra. We tried using a spherical coordinate system instead of a rectangular one, thinking it might be more natural to the heptapods given their anatomy, but that approach wasn't any more fruitful. The heptapods didn't seem to understand what we were getting at. Likewise, the physics discussions went poorly. Only with the most concrete terms, like the names of the elements, did we have any success. After several attempts at representing the periodic table, the heptapods got the idea. For anything remotely abstract, we might as well have been gibbering. We tried to demonstrate basic physical attributes, like mass and acceleration, so we could elicit their terms for them, but the heptapods simply responded with requests for clarification. To avoid perceptual problems that might be associated with any particular medium, we tried physical demonstrations as well as line drawings, photos, and animations. None were effective. Days with no progress became weeks, and the physicists were becoming disillusioned. By contrast, the linguists were having much more success. We made steady progress decoding the grammar of the spoken language, Heptapod A. It didn't follow the pattern of human languages as expected, but it was comprehensible so far, free word order, even to the extent that there was no preferred order for the clauses in a conditional statement, in defiance of a human language, universal. It also appeared that the heptapods had no objection to many levels of center embedding of clauses, something that quickly defeated humans. Peculiar, but not impenetrable. Much more interesting were the newly discovered morphological and grammatical processes in Heptapod B that were uniquely two-dimensional. Depending on a semigram's declension, inflections could be indicated by varying a certain stroke's curvature, or its thickness, or its manner of undulation, or by varying the relative sizes of 2 radicals, or their relative distance to another radical, or their orientations, or various other means. These were non-segmental graphemes. They couldn't be isolated from the rest of a semigram. And despite how such traits behaved in human writing, these had nothing to do with calligraphic style. Their meanings were defined according to a consistent and unambiguous grammar. We regularly asked the heptapods why they had come. Each time they answered, to see or to observe. Indeed, sometimes they preferred to watch us silently rather than answer our questions. Perhaps they were scientists. Perhaps they were tourists. The State Department instructed us to reveal as little as possible about humanity, in case that information could be used as a bargaining chip in subsequent negotiations. We obliged, though it didn't require much effort. The heptapods never asked questions about anything, whether scientists or tourists. They were an awfully incurious bunch. I remember once when we'll be driving to the mall to buy some new clothes for you. You'll be 13. One moment you'll be sprawled in your seat, completely unself-conscious, all child. The next, you'll toss your hair with a practiced casualness, like a fashion model in training. You'll give me some instructions as I'm parking the car.
Okay, Mom, give me one of the credit cards, and we can meet back at the entrance here in 2 hours.
I'll laugh. Not a chance. Well, the credit cards stay with me.
You're kidding!
You'll become the embodiment of exasperation. We'll get out of the car, and I will start walking to the mall entrance. After seeing that I won't budge on the matter, you'll quickly reformulate your plans.
Okay, Mom. Okay. You can come with me. Just walk a little ways behind me so it doesn't look like we're together. If I see any friends of mine, I'm going to stop and talk to them. But you just keep walking, okay? I'll come find you later.
I'll stop in my tracks.
Excuse me? I am not the hired help, nor am I some mutant relative for you to be ashamed of.
But, Mom, I can't let anyone see you with me.
What are you talking about? I've already met your friends. They've been to the house.
That was different,
you'll say, incredulous that you have to explain it.
This is shopping.
Too bad.
Then the explosion.
You won't do the least thing to make me happy. You don't care about me at all.
It won't have been that long since you enjoyed going shopping with me. It will forever astonish me how quickly you grow out of one phase and enter another. Living with you will be like aiming for a moving target. You'll always be further along than I expect.
I looked at the sentence in Heptapod B that I had just written, using simple pen and paper. Like all the sentences I generated myself, this one looked misshapen, like a heptapod written sentence that had been smashed with a hammer and then inexpertly taped back together. I had sheets of such inelegant semigrams covering my desk, fluttering occasionally when the oscillating fan swung past. It was strange trying to learn a language that had no spoken form. Instead of practicing my pronunciation, I had taken to squeezing my eyes shut and trying to paint semigrams on the insides of my eyelids. There was a knock at the door, and before I could answer, Gary came in looking jubilant.
Illinois got a repetition in physics.
Really? That's great. When did it happen?
It happened a few hours ago. We just had the video conference. Let me show you what it is.
He started erasing my blackboard. Don't worry, I didn't need any of that.
Good.
He picked up a nub of chalk and drew a diagram.
Okay, here's the path a ray of light takes when crossing from air to water. The light ray travels in a straight line until it hits the water. The water has a different index of refraction, so the light changes direction. You've heard of this before, right?
I nodded. Sure.
Now, here's an interesting property about the path the light takes. The path is the fastest possible route between these two points.
Come again?
Imagine, just for grins, that the ray of light traveled along this path.
He added a dotted line to his diagram.
This hypothetical path is shorter than the path the light actually takes, but light travels more slowly in water than it does in air, and a greater percentage of this path is underwater, so it would take longer for light to travel along this path than it does along the real path.
Okay, I get it.
Now imagine if light were to travel along this other path.
He drew a second dotted path.
This path reduces the percentage that's underwater, but the total length is larger. It would also take longer for light to travel along this path than along the actual one.
Gary put down the chalk and gestured at the diagram on the chalkboard with white-tipped fingers.
Any hypothetical path would require more time to traverse than the one actually taken. In other words, the route that the light ray takes is always the fastest possible one. That's Fermat's principle of least time.
Interesting. And this is what the heptapods responded to?
Exactly. Moorhead gave an animated presentation of Fermat's principle at the Illinois Looking Glass, and the heptapods repeated it back. Now he's trying to get a symbolic description.
He grinned.
Now is that highly neat, or what?
It's neat, all right. But how come I haven't heard of Fermat's principle before? I picked up a binder and waved it at him. It was a primer on the physics topics suggested for use in communication with the heptapods. This thing goes on forever about Planck masses and the spin flip of atomic hydrogen, and not a word about the refraction of light.
We guessed wrong about what would be most useful for you to know,
Gary said without embarrassment.
In fact,
It's curious that Fermat's principle was the first breakthrough. Even though it's easy to explain, you need calculus to describe it mathematically. And not ordinary calculus. You need the calculus of variations. We thought that some simple theorem of geometry or algebra would be the breakthrough.
Curious indeed.
You think the heptapod's idea of what's simple doesn't match ours? Exactly, which is why I'm dying to see what their mathematical description of Fermat's principle looks like.
He paced as he talked.
If their version of the calculus of variations is simpler to them than their equivalent of algebra, that might explain why we've had so much trouble talking about physics. Their entire system of mathematics may be topsy-turvy compared to ours.
He pointed to the physics primer.
You can be sure that we're going to revise that.
So can you build from Fermat's principle to other areas of physics?
Probably. There are lots of physical principles just like Fermat's. What, like Louise's principle of least closet space?
When did physics become so minimalist?
Well, the word least is misleading. You see, Fermat's principle of least time is incomplete. In certain situations, light follows a path that takes more time than any of the other possibilities. It's more accurate to say that light always follows an extreme path, either one that minimizes the time taken, or one that maximizes it. A minimum and a maximum share certain mathematical properties, so both situations can be described with one equation, so to be precise, Fermat's principle isn't a minimal principle. Instead, it's what's known as a variational principle.
And there are more of these variational principles?
He nodded. In all branches of physics, almost every physical law can be restated as a variational principle. The only difference between these principles is in which attribute is minimized or maximized.
He gestured, as if the different branches of physics were arrayed before him on a table.
In optics, where Fermat's principle applies, time is the attribute that has to be an extreme. In mechanics, it's a different attribute. In electromagnetism, it's something else again. But all these principles are similar mathematically.
So once you get their mathematical description of Fermat's principle, you should be able to decode the other ones.
God, I hope so. I think this is the wedge that we've been looking for. The one that cracks open their formulation of physics. This calls for a celebration.
He stopped his pacing and turned to me.
Hey, Louise, want to go out for dinner? My treat?
I was mildly surprised.
Sure,
I said. It'll be when you first learn to walk that I get daily demonstrations of the asymmetry in our relationship. You'll be incessantly running off somewhere, and each time you walk into a doorframe or scrape your knee, the pain feels like it's my own. It'll be like growing an errant limb, an extension of myself whose sensory nerves report pain just fine, but whose motor nerves don't convey my commands at all. It's so unfair. I'm going to give birth to an animated voodoo doll of myself. I didn't see this in the contract when I signed up. Was this part of the deal? And then there will be the times when I see you laughing, like the time you'll be playing the neighbor's puppy, poking your hands through the chain-link fence separating our backyards, and you'll be laughing so hard you'll start hiccuping. The puppy will run inside the neighbor's house, and your laughter will gradually subside, letting you catch your breath. Then the puppy will come back to the fence to lick your fingers again, and you'll shriek and start laughing again. It will be the most wonderful sound I could ever imagine, a sound that makes me feel like a fountain or a wellspring. Now, if I can only remember that sound the next time your blithe disregard for self-preservation gives me a heart attack. After the breakthrough with Fermat's principle, discussions of scientific concepts became more fruitful. It wasn't as if all of heptapod physics was suddenly rendered transparent, but progress was steady. According to Gary, the heptapod's formulation of physics was indeed topsy-turvy relative to ours. Physical attributes that humans defined using integral calculus were seen as fundamental by the heptapods. As an example, Gary described an attribute that, in physics jargon, bore the deceptively simple name action, which represented the difference between kinetic and potential energy integrated over time, whatever that meant. Calculus for us, elementary to them. Conversely,
To define attributes that humans thought of as fundamental, like velocity, the heptapods employed mathematics that were, Gary assured me, highly weird. The physicists were ultimately able to prove the equivalence of heptapod mathematics and human mathematics, even though their approaches were almost the reverse of one another. Both were systems of describing the same physical universe. I tried following some of the equations that the physicists were coming up with, but it was no use. I couldn't really grasp the significance of physical attributes like action. I couldn't, with any confidence, ponder the significance of treating such an attribute as fundamental. Still, I tried to ponder questions formulated in terms more familiar to me. What kind of worldview did the heptapods have that they would consider Fermat's principle the simplest explanation of light refraction? What kind of perception made a minimum or maximum readily apparent to them? Your eyes will be blue like your dad's, not mud brown like mine. Boys will stare into those eyes the way I did, and do, into your dad's, surprised and enchanted as I was and am, to find them in combination with black hair. You will have many suitors. I remember when you were 15, coming home after a weekend at your dad's, incredulous over the interrogation he'll have put you through regarding the boy you're currently dating. You'll sprawl on the sofa, recounting your dad's latest breach of common sense.
You know what he said? He said, I know what teenage boys are like.
Full of the eyes.
Like I don't.
Don't hold it against him, I'll say. He's a father. He can't help it. Having seen you interact with your friends, I won't worry much about a boy taking advantage of you. If anything, the opposite will be more likely. I'll worry about that.
He wishes I were still a kid. He hasn't known how to act toward me since I grew breasts.
Well, that development was a shock for him. Give him time to recover.
It's been years, Mom. How long is it going to take?
I'll let you know when my father's come to terms with mine. During one of the video conferences for the linguists, Cisnero from the Massachusetts Looking Glass had raised an interesting question. Was there a particular order in which semigrams were written in a heptapod B sentence? It was clear that word order meant next to nothing when speaking in heptapod A. When asked to repeat what it had just said, a heptapod would likely as not use a different word order, unless we specifically asked them not to. Was word order similarly unimportant when writing in heptapod B? Previously, we had focused our attention only on how a sentence in heptapod B looked once it was complete. As far as anyone could tell, there was no preferred order when reading the semigrams in a sentence. You could start almost anywhere in the nest, then follow the branching clauses until you'd read the whole thing. But that was reading. Was the same true about writing? During my most recent session with Flapper and Raspberry, I had asked them if, instead of displaying a semigram only after it was completed, they could show it to us while it was being written. They had agreed. I inserted the videotape of the session into the VCR, and on my computer, I consulted the session transcript. I picked one of the longer utterances from the conversation. What Flapper had said was that the heptapod's planet had two moons, one significantly larger than the other. The three primary constituents of the planet's atmosphere were nitrogen, argon, and oxygen. And 15/28 of the planet's surface was covered by water. The first words of the spoken utterance translated literally as inequality of size, rocky orbiter, rocky orbiters related as primary to secondary. Then, I rewound the videotape until the time signature matched the one in the transcription. I started playing the tape and watched the web of semigrams being spun out of inky spider's silk. I rewound it and played it several times. Finally, I froze the video right after the first stroke was completed and before the second one was begun. All that was visible on screen was a single sinuous line. Comparing that initial stroke with the completed sentence, I realized that the stroke participated in several different clauses of the message. It began in a semigram for oxygen as a determinant that distinguished it from certain other elements. Then it slid down to become the morpheme of comparison in the description of the two moon sizes,
And lastly, it flared out as the arched backbone of the semigram for ocean. Yet this stroke was a single continuous line, and it was the first one that Flapper wrote. That meant the heptapod had to know how the entire sentence would be laid out before it could write the very first stroke. The other strokes in the sentence also traversed several clauses, making them so interconnected that none could be removed without redesigning the entire sentence. The heptapods didn't write a sentence one semigram at a time. They built it out of strokes irrespective of individual semigrams. I had seen a similarly high degree of integration before in calligraphic designs, particularly those employing the Arabic alphabet. But those designs had required careful planning by expert calligraphers. No one could lay out such an intricate design at the speed needed for holding a conversation. At least, no human could. There's a joke that I once heard a comedian tell. It goes like this. I'm not sure if I'm ready to have children. I asked a friend of mine who has children. Suppose I do have kids. What if when they grow up, they blame me for everything that's wrong with their lives? She laughed and said, What do you mean, if? That's my favorite joke. Gary and I were at a little Chinese restaurant, one of the local places we had taken to patronizing to get away from the encampment. We sat eating the appetizers, pot stickers, redolent of pork and sesame oil, my favorite. I dipped one in soy sauce and vinegar. So how are you doing with your heptapod B practice? I asked. Gary looked obliquely at the ceiling. I tried to meet his gaze, but he kept shifting it. You've given up, haven't you? I said. You're not even trying anymore. He did a wonderful hangdog expression. I'm just no good at languages, he confessed. I thought learning heptapod B might be more like learning mathematics and trying to speak another language, but it's not. It's too foreign for me. It would help you discuss physics with them. Probably, but since we had our breakthrough, I can get by with just a few phrases. I sighed. I suppose that's fair. I have to admit, I've given up on trying to learn the mathematics. So we're even? We're even. I sipped my tea. Though I did want to ask you about Fermat's principle. Something about it feels odd to me, but I can't put my finger on it. It just doesn't sound like a law of physics. A twinkle appeared in Gary's eyes. Oh, then I know what you're talking about. He snipped a pot sticker in half with his chopsticks. You're used to thinking of refraction in terms of cause and effect. Reaching the water's surface is the cause, and the change in direction is the effect. But Fermat's principle sounds weird because it describes light's behavior in goal-oriented terms. It sounds like a commandment to a light beam, thou shalt minimize or maximize the time taken to reach thy destination. I considered it. Go on. It's an old question in the philosophy of physics. People have been talking about it since Fermat first formulated it in the 1600s. Planck wrote volumes about it. The thing is, while the common formulation of physical laws is causal, a variational principle like Fermat's is purposive, almost teleological.
That's an interesting way to put it. Let me think about that for a minute.
I pulled out a felt-tip pen and, on my paper napkin, drew a copy of the diagram that Gary had drawn on my blackboard.
Okay, I said, thinking aloud. So let's say the goal of a ray of light is to take the fastest path. How does a light go about doing that?
Well, if I can speak anthropomorphic projectionally, the light has to examine the possible paths and compute how long each one would take.
He plucked the last pot sticker from the serving dish.
And to do that, I continued, the ray of light has to know just where its destination is. If the destination were somewhere else, the fastest path would be different.
Gary nodded again.
That's right. The notion of a fastest path is meaningless unless there's a destination specified. And computing how long a given path takes also requires information.